welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Gerald Stern. Gerald Stern was born in Pittsburgh in 1925 and was educated at the University of Pittsburgh and Columbia University. He is the author of 20 books of poetry, 2 books of prose, and 1 play, including most recently In Beauty Bright, published by Norton in 2012, Save the Last Dance, and Everything is Burning, as well as This Time, New and Selected Poems, which won the 1998 National Book Award. The paperback of his personal essays titled What I Can't Bear Losing was published in the fall of 2009 by Trinity University Press. He was awarded the 2005 Wallace Stevens Award by the Academy of American Poets and is currently a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. He is retired from the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. Early Collected Poems from 1965 to 1992 was published by Norton in the spring of 2010. Stern's Stealing History, a kind of memoir, was published in early 2012 by Trinity University Press. And I want to welcome you, Jerry. It's so great to have you in Pittsburgh.
It's great to be here, Jan, dear.
Yeah. And you're gonna start with some poems by In Beauty Bright.
Okay. I'm going to read a short poem. It's called Frogs, and it takes us back to our 10th grade biology classes that we all shared in the horror days, called high school. The part that we avoided was not the heart, but what we called the pouch, for it still swelled, or seemed to, and there was plenty of horror cutting into what made the music, or at least the agency, you might call it. And more than one of us retched. And as you know, that can become contagious. Think of a room full of pouches exploding. Think of the music on a summer night with no one conducting. And think of how warm it might be and how love songs may have gotten started there. Okay, let me read one more poem. Called the Frick Mansion. It's in New York City, and everybody loves the Frick Mansion because of its great collection of Impressionist paintings. But that was all made, as we know, and forgive me for saying this, on the back of workers who were underpaid, overworked, died betimes, to the benefit of this rather horrible human being named Frick. It's a very short poem. Figuring up what you might call an exchange, and only for a painting, but not counting the claim of a share in the 60 rooms or counting a share of the inflation compared to the mean reduction of so many bodies in such a heavy cardboard box or two, I'd say 350 to 750, taking in a complicated system of matching death payments with the cost of buying or stealing. Or I'd say 300 dead Slovaks for one Caravaggio.
Great poem. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Gerald Stern, reading from his new book, In Beauty Bright. Jerry, I know that you're a fan of saying it real, saying it straight, and that you do not believe in what you call, in your latest memoir, mystification.
Right.
Can you talk just a little bit about that for people who haven't heard you talk about
well,
it?
Well, first of all, I am a fan of saying real things straight, but by straight, I might mean somewhat crooked even to get at the straight, because there I'm talking about language. And you have to subvert sometimes language in poetry, maybe in prose too. You have to come in the back door, you have to steal in the top window, and so on and so on. So one must really pay close attention to a poem before you get at the truth. But that's not mystification, that's communication. Mystification is lying, stealing. It's what corporations do, what advertising companies do, what political parties do, what bosses do at universities, in businesses, when they say, this is for your own good. It's what you enter an airport and they search you, and I say over and over, I'm going to be body searched, right? Patted down, because I have lead in my body from being shot. Now, it was from a holdup, but I lie and say I was shot in the war, in the Battle of the Bulge. and I say, don't say this is for my own good. I always say, don't say this is for my own good. Mystification is lying. It's concealing. It's confusing. And I'm anti-mystification. And I suspect that, if I may say this, that the Western male religions, Judaism, Christianity, and the Muslim religion, are most adept at mystification. Music helps, incense, color, costumes, thrones. It's to abuse you, terrify you, abase you, put you in a place of terror where you have to salute. So that's what I mean by mystification. And you may remember a couple of weeks ago when I was reading in Pittsburgh, I had the opportunity to read from a section of Stealing History concerned with demystification. And I ended up, for the first time in my life, in a sort of two paragraphs saying what I really believed in. Mm-hmm. And it was such a joy to say that. And I'm not going to repeat it, but it was basically not to believe in magic rooms, not to believe in thrones. You know, I'm going to end up this by singing a song from World War I. Because, you see, in the army is a place of deep mystification where you have to salute people above you and obey them willy-nilly, whatever they say. Go in there and die. It goes like this. Would you rather be a private than a colonel in the army? A private has more fun when his day's work is done. On all his strikes, on all his hikes, every town he strikes, girls discover him and just smother him with things he likes. But when the colonel passes by, the girlies act so shy, they hold their heads so high with dignity. So would you rather be a colonel with an eagle on your shoulder, or a private with a chicken on your knee? And that's it, man, woman.
I think that's our first Army song on prosody. Thank you, Jerry.
Yeah.
Could you read some more poems?
Sure. I'm going to read a poem about Walt Whitman. I have several poems about him. And, you know, people are always saying that I come out of Whitman. And it's so obvious that I do repetition in the long line and that I have certain political attitudes. But I sort of came to resent that. And then I came to love him again. And he spent his last few years in a city which was once a thriving small metropolis, Camden, New Jersey, which now has 70% unemployment, empty lots, broken glass everywhere, one of our hundreds of ruined cities in America. The poem is called Broken Glass, and it's on Mickle Street, and Whitman's house was there, and I lay down in his bed, and I thought of this poem, which I finally wrote. Broken bottles brought him to Mickle Street, and pieces of glass embedded in the mud to Whitman's wooden house across the street from the church of the most unhappy Redeemer. For when it was too quiet, he broke another bottle, and he collected his glass in a paper bag. And when he was forlorn, that means lost. And when he was forlorn, He cut himself, though, just as like he cut himself on a wall while doing an exercise to stretch the tendon so he could get rid of the numb and burning feeling. Or sometimes he sat on a hydrant and once on a bench with drooping slats. So when the slats gave, his back also gave, and feeling came back to his foot as it came back to Whitman when he sat on the orange rush seats or rocked in his chair between the visits and loved the hollyhocks that grew in the cracks. And for a nickel, the whole republic would turn to broken glass, as Oscar insisted. And that would be Oscar Wilde, who in this poem was visiting him. People came from all, and he did indeed visit him. People came from everywhere to visit the old gray poet who loved being an old gray poet. I don't quite love being an old gray poet the way he did. He even planned his own tomb, which is huge, because in that age it was kind of a great honor to die instead of something embarrassing and secret, you know. Well, but that takes us into another place and away from poetry.
Yeah, could you read some more? More poems, please?
Another poem, okay. Let's see. I'm going to read a poem about Eleanor Roosevelt, who was one of my heroes. And as people might know, though people don't seem to know much anymore, some people, she was a good friend of the then Vice President, Henry Wallace, who was earlier the Secretary of Agriculture, and so on and so on. And they met secretly at a restaurant at Number 1 Fifth Avenue. The restaurant was called Number 1 Fifth Avenue. It was at Number 1 Fifth Avenue. And this is a poem. And they planned their strategy, how to get Franklin, FDR, to be a little more radical and a little less political. She kept dropping her papers in front of Number 1 Fifth, which first started when she got out of a yellow DeSoto, and it was either a head waiter or a doorman who rushed out to pick them up and help her into the lobby where Henry Wallace was waiting. And you should know that though she hated his theory of eggs, she sided with him on other things. And it was Franklin they discussed, and it was the age of the seesaw and the cardboard shoe. And both of them screamed with laughter at Oysters Rockefeller. Just imagine naming food for him. How about calling soup cream of Carnegie? How about putting your canines to work on fried frick or chopped harriman? And God, they hated Cardinal Spellman even before he was the priest of war and a free busing. And both of them loved the Buddha and listened together to the sound of the Mineta Creek suddenly surfacing in the lobby across the street, Number 2, and they stood back to back to see who was taller. And everywhere in America, boys of 15 read her column before they read the funnies and put her picture beside the one of their maternal grandmothers. The girls were more wary, except a few, and Adley loved her, and Harry, and Lyndon. And in the Church of the Ascension, in front of the John Lafargue or back of the sculpted angel, she shook hands and half bent down the way a tall woman does to kiss someone. It could be any century, and it could be her friend or a loving stranger, a former slave or a boy of 15. And, of course, I was the boy of 15. And I must say, it was possible for a former slave then, when I was 15, to still be alive, a black slave. I read this poem shortly after I wrote it a number of times, and my partner, Anne Marie, would come to my readings, and people would ask me, did you know Eleanor Roosevelt? I said, of course, it's in the poem. And I'd go on and on. How I ate lunch with her and God knows what. And Anne Marie looked at me and she said, you never met Eleanor Roosevelt. I said, that's not the point.
It's a poem. Yeah. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Gerald Stern, reading from his new book, In Beauty Bright. You know, there's a lot of Pittsburgh in your poems, which I love, and I love when you talk about the Fricks and the Melons, and you know, it's just, I'm just so glad that Pittsburgh keeps coming and coming in your work, and I know that's that you write about so many other things, but we were talking about how to keep writing the other day, and you said that writing is 60% will.
Right.
And can you talk a little bit about that for our listeners out there who are struggling to write or not having success?
Well, you know, everybody is a musician. Everybody has a sense of music, of rhythm. Some people, some poets really don't have a strong beginning sense of rhythm. Luckily, and I'm being a little technical here, and I hope it's not too sophisticated, free verse allows us to do different things that more formal and prescribed verse didn't. But that carries the subject away from the question. I insist that for any artist, will is the issue. It's 70%. Sometimes I say 90% will. Now, Andy Warhol, who was a student at Carnegie Tech before it was named after the two guys, Carnegie and Mellon, was at art school with my former wife, and I drove him, as I said in my book of essays, to the then existing East Liberty train station, when he went off to New York to draw shoes, to be a commercial artist for I.B. Miller Shoe Company. And Andy had an enormous will. He willed himself to be a great artist, and he was lucky, and he was able, but he knew what to imitate and who to talk to. He was almost as cunning, or maybe more so, than that other Andy Carnegie. And he changed his name a little bit to Warhol, and he made appropriate friendships, and he hung on, and he did what he was told, and he did what he wasn't told, but it was all will. And suddenly he became the center of the artistic universe, and of course he has a huge following now. They named a bridge after him, Sixth Street Bridge. He and I used to walk across it, and I'm kind of angry it's not named the Gerald Stern Bridge, but the Andy Warhol Bridge, or Andy Warhola Bridge. And I kind of liked him a lot. And he was very gifted. But he chose to do what he chose to do. And that explains Will, his success, almost more than anybody I can think of.
Okay, could you read some more poems?
Sure. I'm going to read the two poems. The one of them is the title poem of this book. It's called In Beauty Bright, page 56. 56. It's a short poem. And it invokes the name of Blake, William Blake, who is one of my masters. And you, Jan, are the other. In beauty bright and such, it was like Blake's lily. And though an angel, he looked absurd, dragging a lily out of a beauty bright store, wrapped in tissue with a petal drooping. Nor was it useless. You who know it know how useful it is, and how he would be dead in a minute if he were to lose it, though how do you lose a lily? His lily was white, and he had a foolish smile there, holding it up like a candelabrum in his right hand, facing the mirror in the hall. Nor had the endless century started yet, nor was there one thorn between his small house and the beauty bright store. I said I'd read two poems. Let me just find another. How are we doing on time? Okay.
Oh,
we
great,
Let me find another poem to read. This, by the way, this book, In Beauty Bright, is dedicated to my friends in Pittsburgh during the dark time, referring to my youth, but I guess we're still in the dark time. Hey, here's a poem called Dumb. And it celebrates walking across. I live now, as you know, in a small city called Lambertville on the Delaware River facing the canal. And as I used to walk along the canal, I mean walk on the towpath along the canal, there would be a little wooden bridge. And I celebrate in this poem trying to walk across that bridge, and maybe on a beautiful Saturday morning, the bikers dominating the bridge, coming down with their bikes. But it's about a flower called fleabane, a kind of, I guess it's a weed. Not to me, it's not. I love weeds. Fleabane again, and I have another year to take up its redness and what the wayside is like with or without it. And I have another year to charge across the wooden bridge and shake it again and take on the animals and fight the stupid bikes and the bikers who ride across with their legs spread out instead of walking their bikes so we didn't have to be pushed against the rails. They are so dumb, and their bikes have so many dumb and useless gears, like a dumb idiot box with 2,000 stations. Only dumb ancient boxing and ancient movies worth anything. Jack Johnson or Marciano, even Orson Welles too much. Give me the unself-conscious Carl Malden or Gene Harlow, for this is an old flower. It hates whatever it wants to. It grows where it wants, and it loves goats because of their flattened eyes. And I guess I'm that flower. People might say, well, how'd you happen to write a poem about a fleabane? Who knows? I mean, where the imagination takes you. And I guess I ended, I don't know, the poem started in a kind of anger at these bikers, and there are hundreds of gears. I mean, I can respect a bike with three gears, but, you know, 30 gears or 2,000 gears or 18, forget it. I mean, I know I'm being old-fashioned and mean, but so what? And so I became a fleabane during the course of that poem, which looks like a daisy in a red center and has tiny little petals surrounding it, but much, much tinier than a daisy, and colored and with a reddish tint to the flower. I just love them, fleabane. I love the word too, fleabane. I don't know. I forget where it came from.
Mm-hmm. One thing, so many things I love about your work, but one thing I love is how we move from we didn't never know where we're going.
I never know where I'm going either. Just to interrupt you for a second, in my book, Stealing History, that prose book with 85 sections, I have a thing on chance writing. I go on and on about chance writing and talk about its origin in the 8th and 9th century. And I guess that's what I do. And I just, it's sort of having faith in that somehow it will turn out all right. You're into a poem or an essay, and God, you're forsaken and you're lost in the woods. But you know that if you keep walking, a tiger won't eat you, or a snake won't bite you. But you'll see the road again, or the air again. You know, that's called chance writing. I guess that governs me. Associative writing, maybe it would be called in a class. You know, associative writing. Go ahead.
Well, either way.
But you were in the middle of a question.
Well, no, that was sort of part of it. But I was, you know, like in one of your poems, we can go from something overtly political to something funny, and then all of a sudden something very sad. And it's, you know, I've been in audiences where you've been reading and people are laughing, and then very shortly after they're very quiet. And I love that movement in your work. And I'm wondering how you get to the very human. I feel like your work is...
Well, I have another section in that prose book on comedy. I think comedy is much more human than tragedy. I think comic is more interesting than tragic. It covers a wider range. I do love Lear, and I do love Marlowe's work, so much Dostoevsky, but there's an element, and I think it's partly Jewish, but not exclusively, where comedy and tragedy are combined, and we see it in some of our famous comics, and I'm always catching audiences with their mouths open when I start off, and partly it's embarrassment and delusional and deliberately delusional and attempt to either outwit the audience or outwit myself or outwit God or God knows what. I do that, and then sometimes after a reading, somebody will come up and say, one of the things that I hate the most, you are a you are a great stand-up comedian, and I want to kill them. For, you know, I wanted them to say you're a good poet. I want to be a stand-up. I mean, I really don't much care for stand-up comedians. Mm-hmm. Most of them are stupid. There are a couple of very, very good ones. But the lesser breed of them are embarrassingly bad and repetitive, and everything is planned, really. There are some great stand-up comedians, but just a few.
Okay, we have time for a couple more poems.
Okay, couple more poems. Okay. No more songs, though.
Whatever you want
to. All right, let me get that table of contents and see where I am. Okay. So what if I read a poem which I didn't read that when I gave that reading in Pittsburgh called Why Anger Like That? And then end up with a poem called Counting. So 119 and 109. So why anger like that? Because people always ask me, why are you so angry? As if Isaiah wasn't 10 times more angry than me, or Jeremiah. Why anger like that? If for no other reason that their shoes were black and their soles were made of hard chewing gum, or that they made a deaf man's life miserable, or for no other reason that they made him remember Little Russia, where the whole city didn't speak English, and there were 15 horns and 20 strings going north and south between one tree-lined street and another, and no other reason given that they killed their firstborn sons. And one time someone tried to introduce into the diet charred birds on sticks. And one time it rained so hard that all three rivers became a lake, and fish swam by on Water Street across from the restaurant, and a murder of cats stood by to watch and time to time to stab and pull the bleeding bodies from the water in answer to your question, since you're the fourth person to ask. Nor is there any issue concerning the universes, and I've found the strongest proponents live in old trailer courts and argue around the spigots. You know me, and I should be burying a steel box in the mud by this time, so you who live differently can stir the dust and make a few things out, for it's you I love. I got it from Auden. I got it from a saint you'd never recognize, who lay drenched through and through from the meadow he slept all night in, waiting for morning. So there's a great example of not answering the question or of half answering it. And now I'm going to finish with this short poem called Counting for Anne Marie. You remind me always it's 13 years. So when I sit with my calendar or after with just my fingers, I can't remember or just confuse myself by trying to put my things in order. But I am almost always wrong, and I have to empty the room and pull the blinds down and fold up the rug and sweep the floor and put a wooden chair under the window so I can think by squeezing the rungs until the veins in my hands turn blue. For in the beginning, I climbed into your car, and 2 weeks later, though neither of us gave it a thought, we walked across the street for breakfast where there was an ocean nearby. And that's the morning we started counting.
It's the poetry of Gerald Stern. Thank you so much for being here, Jerry.
It's a great pleasure, Jen. Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.